Please welcome Tony Peterle.
All right. I want to say, first off, thank you to all of you for your attention. Thanks again to the Wisconsin Broadcast Association for having this clinic every year for us and for inviting me to come up and do a presentation. If you want to ask about the car, we can talk about that later on. But it was something that I'll just tell you. It's a 1947 MGTC that my father and I restored back in the early 80s. And about 3 years ago, I resurrected it from the shed where it had sat untouched for over 5 years and drove it from Ohio all the way down to Florida, some 1,300 miles. It was the adventure of a lifetime. So we are here today to talk about creating the ultimate IP audio network. Now, we've heard and have been hearing lots about things that you could do with audio inside your own plant or to provide streaming for consumer use. But we're talking about building a network to deliver content, be it audio, video, or what have you, in the Badlands, in the area outside the wall, so to speak. The big, bad, nasty public internet, iffy networks, bad networks, places where bad things can happen and bad people lurk. Or the other explanation is that may be just the Packers entering Lambeau Field in January. I'm not quite sure. So what do we want out of this audio network? What do we, you know, once we generate the content that we want in our studios and our facilities, how do we want to get that out to the places that we want to in various places around the country or around the world? What are the criteria? Well, first off, this network should be very resilient, because like I said, the internet is not a reliable network. In aggregate, it can be. Individual links can be weak, but in aggregate, the self-healing properties and the rerouting properties of the internet can actually work to our advantage. But we've got to have the resilience to deal with those flakiness. You know, when a node somewhere goes down, to be able to deal with the big jump and jitter when the traffic gets rerouted through a different node. So it's got to be redundant. It's got to be able to heal itself and govern itself and be intelligent. Ideally, what we're looking for is the reliability of a T1 connection and the ability to make random point-to-point connections like an ISDN, but we'd also like to keep the benefits of having it on an IP network, the scalability, the affordability. IP network is really cheap bandwidth when you compare it to a T1 or an ISDN link. IP is a lot more affordable. So we'd like to have that flexibility, the ability to deliver a stream from one point to several points rather than just point-to-point connection like a T1 or an ISDN link would be. Understandably, though, the technologies, and there are several that go into making this a possibility, they're not all going to be needed in every instance. So we look for modularity, for the ability to apply different technologies as needed by the customer to get the performance, the network performance that they want. So the content's got to get there. It's got to get there on time, right? If we didn't care about the delay, we could just mail USB keys with the audio files on them. That way we know the audio would you know, we'll send somebody a CD. That way we know the audio is going to be perfect when it gets there. Well, it's not going to be there for several days. So it's got to be there. It's got to be good. It's got to be on time in near real time. I don't know if that's an official term or not, but obviously nothing on the internet is in exactly real time. There is always some latency inherent in delivering content across a great distance. So near real-time audio, it's got to be intact. We've got to be able to communicate and control the various elements on this network as we distribute it and use it. That means we've got to have some sort of intelligence. We've got to have the SNMP protocol is very useful for this kind of thing. And also, to enhance the redundancy and the resiliency, we need to be able to find alternate sources. If our primary source for an audio stream goes away, we've got to have places that we can go that we can find alternate sources for that same audio stream. So we're going to talk about some things that we've done. First off, the redundant streaming. This is a technology that we pioneered, first introduced to the market back in 2011. So we've been at this for a while. We've got a lot of users all over the world. It offers flawless or near flawless audio distribution and a constant link delay. Doesn't add any extra latency to the link. So you're not delaying your audio, and it can handle some fairly large swings of delay jitter. Now, I talk about all this not specifically as it relates to our equipment, because in the intervening years, other manufacturers have also adopted similar technology. Why? Because it works. So it's quite simple, a little complicated behind the scenes, but the overall concept is quite simple. It's wearing a belt with your suspenders. We are sending the audio more than once. So if we, it's supposed to be an animation on that, and it's not animating. All right. So we send more than one stream. We send more than one copy of the data that we need, a little bit like what they do with the HD and the sidebands, right? IBOC broadcasting, all of the information you need for the digital signal is on one set of sidebands, but they put it also on the second set of sidebands for resilience. So as each packet goes through, they're all dumping into a common buffer on the playback end. And if a packet is missing from one stream, it's probably already in the buffer than from the other stream. So the buffer just reassembles the packets in order and plays it out. It's quite simple. If you go back to the Game of Thrones analogy, instead of sending one raven to deliver your information, and again, the animations aren't working, we could send two ravens. There they go. To deliver the information. That way, if somebody shoots one down with a bow and arrow, your message is still going to get through. This being the internet, though, and we've got a lot of bandwidth, we don't necessarily have to stop at two ravens. You could send a whole flock of ravens from point A to point B, all carrying the same data, and that way the others and whoever out there is meaning to do you harm or even unintentionally doing you harm is not going to be able to destroy the data before it gets to the other point. So the redundant streaming technology can work on a single network link, and it's not as effective as if you have dual providers, dual links, but it does cope with packet losses. It will not be able to cope with a loss of connection event. If that link goes down for longer than whatever your buffer is set, you will have a loss of connection. You're going to lose some audio. So, but in general, it does very well against packet losses, especially, you know, we have some things that we can do to the stream to make it even more resilient. But typically, in our real-world scenarios, with a single network link, we are seeing reliability of about 5 nines using redundant streaming on a single network path. And that's relatively good. However, it can get better. If you've got dual ports on the equipment and you've got dual providers at each end, particularly if those can be diverse providers, the more diversity you can introduce into this network layout, the better off you're going to be. So instead of relying on two DSL providers at one end, you have one DSL and one cable, or one fiber and a microwave shot. Again, the more diversity, the better off you're going to be. Because even if you're getting your DSLs from different providers, quote unquote, they're still running on the same backbone. So if the DSL backbone hiccups, then you're going to have problems. So if you've got dual providers, and hypothetically, all of these are accessible or available or on public IP addresses so they can all see each other, you can not only send a pair of parallel streams, you know, network one to network one and network two to network two, but you can also program crossing streams. And in this scenario, any one of those network providers, you could pull the network cable out of any one of those four ports and still have redundancy. You've still got dual paths with at least dual providers on at least a part of that network segment. So when you get up into this kind of a situation, you really find out that you've got a tremendous amount of resiliency. And so you've got, even if your ISP crashes, you've still got redundancy. So the advantages of redundant streaming versus other types of ways to cope with or ameliorate the effects of a poor network, first off, you're not affecting the content. Whether it's audio, video, what have you, you're not scaling back the bit rate. If the network gets bad, the audio quality is always consistent. The playout delay is always consistent. And it can be any kind of data. You can even use MPX over IP, digital MPX over IP, and do it with this redundant streaming. So that's the first advantage. Again, you can use any kind of network bandwidth. We've had customers obviously using the common things like cable and fiber, DSLs, microwave paths. We have some customers even running this redundant streaming technology on satellite. Obviously, your buffer's got to be big enough to accommodate the delay, but in general, you can have pretty good effects on any kind of network bandwidth, even 4G and 3G. You can send to multiple destinations. If the network supports it, you can do multicast with redundant streaming or multiple unicast if the network doesn't support the multicast protocols. Doesn't add any additional delay in the audio, forward error correction, some of the other correction or compensation schemes for bad network audio or bad network paths will add extra delay, which is not necessarily always acceptable. It is scalable, so you can start redundant streaming to one or two sites and end up doing this to 100 sites, however you like to set it up. The performance on a single network link, as we talked about earlier, that approaches five nines. If you've got dual paths, dual providers on each end, the performance approaches perfection. And obviously, I was schooled in mathematics by a very smart lady from a very early age, and we know that there's always a reduction, you know, there's a curve. You can get close to perfection, but you can never quite get there. Zeno, the old Greek philosopher, had a few things to say about that. But we'll say, let's talk about approaching perfection. What does that mean? Well, when we first introduced the technology, we needed a test link, real-world test link. So we set up a link between our development office in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and my office in Miami, Florida. So we've been running this link on and off for 5 years, and generally we use it for software updates, testing different settings, helping customers sometimes improve their or you know, diagnose issues that they may be having on their end, because they're on public internet links, so we can connect with any customers anywhere in the world if they're also on the public internet. We're using very inexpensive DSL and cable. We started out with both dual DSLs on each end, and now I think there's still dual DSL in Belfast. We switched one side of ours in Miami over to a Comcast, our standard Comcast business internet service, a few years ago. And, again, we use it in software updates. Let's test this, let's test that. Well, back in August 2015, we didn't have anything really major to do with it in terms of testing or development, so we decided, all right, let's just see, out of curiosity. We'd had, you know, several stretches where it would run for months at a time with no losses. So we decided, let's just see how long we can go before we lose a packet, one packet. Any guesses? We started in August 2015. How about 160 days plus with zero losses? That's what I mean when I say approaching perfection. So I did that, just happened to do that screenshot in February, 160 days with zero losses, and you can see the individual streams. Now we're hedging our bets, right? We want this to look good. So we're sending four streams because we had the bandwidth. So we're sending four redundant streams from Belfast to Northern Ireland, and you can see the stats for each of the individual streams. Number of packets received, about 351 million. Dropped packets, anywhere from 2,000 to 37,000 dropped packets on any one of the individual streams. Many dozens of loss of connections events happening on all of the streams at various times. But the sum is greater than the parts. You know, the sum, the total, is greater than just the individual links. So what we can see here is that even though the network that we're using is still the same old crappy internet that we're used to, and specifically when I ordered up the DSL connections in Miami, I asked the providers to give us the crappiest service they possibly had. This is not a request that they hear very often. Please give me your worst. I don't care how much it costs. Because we were at a business address, we couldn't get the consumer-grade crappy DSL. We had to get business-grade crappy DSL. So it's costing us like $50 a month. But this is no MPLS. This is no service-level agreements. This is just the cheapest stuff you can buy. And that's the kind of performance we see. Unfortunately, I just happened to take that screenshot in February because 9 days later, we had a little incident. Three tornadoes hit within about a block of our office. We were without power for over a day, which outstripped my UPS system's capability to keep the link up and running. So we lost it again, and since then we've done some more software updates and that kind of thing. We decided to crank up the bit rate. The previous test, that long-term test, was done using the enhanced aptX algorithm, 15 kilohertz stereo. It's about 300 kilobits per second per stream. So then we decided, well, let's let it run at a higher bit rate. We cranked it up to the higher bit rate sample. Before, we were doing about 2 million packets a day. Now, it's about 25 million packets a day. Last reset was on September 30th, and these were the stats as of yesterday when I took this screenshot. Oh, my goodness. That's 11 days, and we've already lost 4 packets. That's terrible, right? And you consider we ran 160 days without a loss. Well, if you look at it, I think I did the math on this one. You can crunch it if you like. 4 packets lost, you can see the bit rate is much higher. So it's 4 packets lost out of about 246 million over the course of those 11 days. So that's still not bad. It's I think, about 7 nines, as I work the math. This also includes Hurricane Matthew, which knocked our Comcast cable out of service for more than 24 hours at the office. So we were running strictly on the DSL side, only 2 streams instead of 4, and that's reflected in the packet totals. You can see the Comcast cable of the first 2 streams, and they're looking at about 228 million. The DSL, which stayed functional after the power came back on, that's our loss of connection event, was the power outage that, again, outlasted my UPS. The DSL side is about 246 million packets. So you can do the math on that at about 25 million packets a day. We were without the cable internet side for the better part of a day, and we still managed to only lose 4 packets out of the total, so completely inaudible. So that's approaching perfection. It can cope with the stuff that the internet throws at you and the bad things that can happen. So we have, of course, customers using SureStream. Cumulus was one of the first to jump on board with some high-value content between San Francisco and New York. They've since added more of these redundant streaming links, KNBR, the Nash FM format, Robin Mead. Does her news broadcasts on the Cumulus Network from her desk at CNN in Atlanta, and that audio is linked to their distribution center by the redundant streaming link. And I eagerly volunteered to go do the installation for that one, but somehow they found somebody else to do it. Mood Media, one of those kind of behind-the-scenes folks, they are the number one provider of background music in the U.S., and they find this technology, this redundant streaming, is very effective for them. They're distributing 120-plus channels of stereo audio from their origin in Fort Mill, South Carolina, to their distribution centers around the country. So it's effective for them and, a few others, CBS Radio, EMF, WNYC. So redundant streaming, and again, we've got other manufacturers now that are doing the same or similar technology. So the market is speaking quite loudly that redundant streaming is the simplest, most effective way to get your content from point A to point B across a marginal network. It's expandable, it's scalable. So the product that you see here on the screen is something that can add that redundancy to an existing link. So with this is not a codec, this is simply a packet replicator and forwarder. So the architecture for this is you have an existing IP link, whether it's public internet or microwave, whatever you're using, you can feed from that codec into one of these replicators. It will generate multiple redundant streams and send them out across multiple networks. Another box catches those multiple streams on the far side and coalesces it down to a single playout stream for the playout codec. So it's a way to add that redundancy to an existing codec link. So that's the first building block, really, in building this ultimate IP audio network. You've got to be able to get one feed from one place to another place reliably. So that part of the equation we feel is solved. So then the next steps, how do you get it to act like an ISDN where you can just dial up different numbers and make connections? How do you get it to resolve and reroute and find alternate sources when something major happens to the network or you lose one of your hardware elements? You could have a codec fail. So with that, we have to have some intelligence in the codecs, or at least that's the best way. You could control it all from external sources if you wanted to, because all of our equipment speaks this SNMP protocol. But we chose to build that intelligence into the codecs. It's a software called ScriptEasy that's available basically in everything we make. It's a remote control graphic interface, really powerful stuff I can show you on the booth later. But this software then running in the codecs can monitor the streams, can monitor for big problems, can say, oh, that stream is gone. Can I ping that codec on the far end? No, I can't. Something major has happened. Let's kick in some backup audio. Let's reroute. Let's find another source for our stream. So it can control the codec, and then that codec through SNMP can control other codecs that it can reach via the network and command extra feeds. So it can perform automatic actions, but it can also work on operator actions and input as well. Plus, if there is a problem, it can send email or even make a phone call, depending on the type of equipment that you're using. So this software can trigger changes in the codec network and apply different profiles based on operator input or a schedule or an emergency. So again, it's part of building this ultimate IP audio network. You've got to get the audio there first, and then you've got to have a way to cope with emergencies, for unusual situations, for big troubles. So on a scheduled basis, you could maybe flip a codec to receive audio from a different source for inserting local content, a local news break or something like that. The codec at the translator site could just switch over and start receiving the stream from the local source, and then when that's done, it can switch back and pick up the main feed from the main network distribution. So activate a new connection profile, and with the fact that this ScriptEasy software is in all of the codecs, you're not reliant on one. So, you know, if one codec fails, maybe that was the one that you had your ScriptEasy in, well, it's in all of them. So all of the codecs can take care of their own little, you know, area of expertise, their own area of responsibility. So if a receive codec out in the field suddenly isn't receiving its stream anymore, it has the smarts then to try and contact the original, the main source, and if that doesn't work, it can then contact another potential source and request a stream from them. So the idea is to get to where you have no single point of failure, so this network can essentially be adaptive and self-healing. So as far as ISDNs, we're actually in the early stages of a project now with a customer that has a news person in one city that does news reports on several stations around the country during the course of the morning drive shift. So with this distributed intelligence and the SNMP communications and the redundant streaming, he's able to hit a button and connect and do his newscast to Seattle or San Francisco or New Orleans just by going click, 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 click. And the codecs will talk to each other. The codecs now even have automatic adaption. They'll auto-detect the incoming stream. So even if the codec on the far end wasn't set up for the correct algorithm, it can automatically reset itself, so it will be. So that's like an ISDN, right? So he can make those individual connections one at a time just like an ISDN codec. But it's IP. So if he is in a situation where he needs to go live on all three markets at the same time, that can be done too. And this is something that couldn't be done with ISDN, but with IP, it's just a snap of the fingers. You send your streams to these three IP addresses, done. Part of how this works then is packet forwarding. So packet forwarding and packet forwarding protection are where we get these extra sources. So a little bit like the drop and insert scheme on the old T1EN SONET rings, any active codec on the network can become a relay point and therefore a source of a stream for any other codec on the network. So the decoders can become backup audio sources. You've got to have, of course, the ability to not only forward the packets themselves, forward the stream, but you've got to have that distributed intelligence. You've got to have some kind of brain in the codec to let you know when you want it to accomplish that. And you have to have, obviously, alternative network paths into the site. If the network path into the site goes down, it doesn't really matter how much intelligence you've got unless you've got another way to get that stream in through another source. So I'll show you one or two examples of that. So the classic theoretical is you have a studio that's distributing audio to several different locations. Maybe it's not the same audio. Maybe you're sending one program to the Miami downtown and the Key West transmitter. You're sending a different program to the Tampa studio. If for some reason the link goes down between Miami and the main transmitter sites, and you've still got connectivity, say it's one of the outgoing links at Miami that's gone down, that particular program is interrupted, so you're not getting your feeds at Miami downtown and Key West. Well, the codecs can recognize that and request a copy of the feed from the Tampa codec. So if the Tampa codec is still getting the audio, it can then turn around and become a source and deliver a copy of each of those streams to the other codecs, again, provided you've got the network connectivity. Also interesting is that you don't have to decode it at the Tampa side. Like I said, you could be feeding program A to Miami downtown and Key West, be feeding program B to Tampa, but that doesn't mean that Tampa couldn't also receive program A and forward it on to the other codecs. It never has to be decoded to audio at the Tampa site. It could just pass right through the network. So you could also have that as like STL path protection. Again, we set up a similar situation like this at a station in California. In that case, they had T1 links going to each of the individual sites, but an IP link between the two. So if one of his T1s went down, he could actually pick up the program from the other site and forward it via IP through his microwave link between the two. Or decoder redundancy. If you have a site with multiple decoders, multiple transmitters, each of those codecs can become a source for the other one. So again, if one of your links or one of your streams goes down, you have a chance to forward that stream through the other codec and get it into the transmitter where it belongs. And another example of the intelligence, the distributed intelligence in the packet forwarding, how it can be put to use to solve issues. And I do need to pause with the logo on the lower right here, and I'm not legally obligated to say this, but I just think it's the polite thing to do. The NBA did not purchase, nor do they endorse the use of our products. It was another legal entity that actually made the purchase. So that being said, what we have is 42 markets, flagship stations, generating the audio for these the different teams. All 42 of those streams are going to their distribution center in Secaucus. And from that point, they are decoded into audio into their regular satellite or however they get their signals out to all of the affiliates that air these feeds. That part is pretty straightforward, very simple. Where it gets more interesting is we can also simultaneously, along with decoding it all to audio, we can actually forward a copy of each of those 42 streams to their content distribution network, Akamai. So we had to do a little work with Akamai to find the right compression algorithm that would mean they wouldn't have to transcode stuff once it got to their end. But once we found which algorithm they preferred, then that's the one we used to send the audio from the 42 flagship station into the Secaucus. So then it's very easy to make a duplicate of each one of those incoming feeds and send it onto the contract distribution network. So that's a whole level of decoding and re-encoding and hassle that they just don't have to go through anymore. And in addition, they have requested and we installed another codec, one more codec, in their NOC, in their control center. It's hooked up to a pair of speakers because they wanted to be able to confirm and listen to the quality of each of those 42 feeds coming in from the markets. So you could do that with, you know, a lot of audio cables, patch cords, some kind of a switching network, whatever you have. But with this, it's all simple because of the intelligence that ScriptEZ software and the SNMP protocol. They can hit a button on their control interface, and that NOC codec will request an additional copy, a second copy of any one of those feeds from any of the markets and play it out through the speakers. So again, it's like a virtual audio switcher. They can just click, I've got their control interface. So the green buttons on the left-hand, or the green tabs on the left-hand side of the buttons will let them know that the feed from each of those markets is up and running. And then when they select one, they just click on the button and that feed will appear in their speakers. And the little tab on the right-hand side of the button will light up and let them know that that's the feed they're listening to right now. So they can go through in, you know, just a few short seconds and click through each of the feeds that they have that are active that night for any particular game time and confirm that the audio is there anytime they like. So we also need to think about, you know, our ultimate IP audio network. What happens if we have a lot of places that we have to feed? If we have to get this particular audio signal, say we have a syndicated program and it needs to go out to 50 stations or 100 stations. Well, you could do that through multicast if the network supports it. And multicasting, the basic concept of it is the replication, the duplication, the generation of all these additional streams happens in the cloud. It happens in the routers and the nodes and the hardware out there on the network. Typically, the internet does not support multicasting. There are some exceptions. I've known some guys that could set up WAN and have that support multicasting, but usually multicasting means you control all the hardware. Not the case if you're trying to distribute a product or a program across the country. So then we think about multiple unicasts. That's also quite effective. That earlier illustration of the news guy in Washington feeding three markets at the same time, that's multiple unicasts. You're actually generating a unique stream, or with redundant streaming, a unique set of streams for each of those markets that go out and accomplish what you want to accomplish. The trouble is that's going to eat up a lot of bandwidth at the source end. Again, particularly with the redundant streaming. So, like I said, we had the stream we were originally sending from Belfast to Miami was 300 kilobits a second. Well, you got to multiply that by two for redundant streaming. So that's 700 kilobits a second. And that's about the maximum limit of some of the DSL links that we had. So if you're distributing and you want to distribute maybe linear audio, or maybe you want to distribute composite MPX over IP, those are, you know, increasingly high bandwidth signals. And if you're doing the redundant streaming, doing those as multiple unicasts gets very expensive on the bandwidth end at the source. You've got to have a big pipe. And sure, you may have a fiber that, you know, gives you 500 megabits a second or a gig or 10 gigs. But, you know, it, you could see if you're doing high quality streaming and redundancy on top of that, it quickly can get to the point where it's outstripping the source that you have. So this packet duplicator replicator kind of thing can come in handy in those situations too, because it can receive one set of streams from your original source, and then if that's in a data center or one of the client stations that has good bandwidth, it can then in turn generate multiple copies of those streams and send them to other destinations. So it's you know, potentially satellite replacement. Certainly for a small content distribution, say you've got a program being generated in Florida and you want to get it out to some affiliates on the West Coast, well, okay, you could use MPLS. That's, you know, gives you an enhanced reliability for the thing. But to get separate MPLS circuits for all of those affiliates on the West Coast is going to be very expensive. And you're still left with the high bandwidth requirements of the source. You've got to have a lot of bandwidth to get those multiple streams out to the destination. So the packet duplicator and replicator can then go closer to the destination. So you would maybe pay for an MPLS link between Florida and the replication center, and then the replication center can use unmanaged links or less expensive links or even a WAN to distribute to the actual affiliates. So your telco costs can be reduced substantially, as opposed to finding a MPLS for each and individual connection. So a little example of what can happen with the telco costs, if you look at, you know, having four affiliates and you were paying for an MPLS for each one, you're going to be spending a little over $6,000 a month. If you do that with the replicator, you can do one MPLS and then, you know, you're less expensive links for the short hops, and save yourself about 43% on your telco costs. And it scales up even more from that. You know, if you're doing 10 affiliates, you can save 55% on your telco costs. These are just rough estimate figures based on, you know, what information we're able to get from the markets. But the possibilities are endless. It's IP. It's everywhere. It's very flexible. So you've got the ability to get a stream from point A to point B and get the content there intact. Again, with this packet replicator duplicator thing, it doesn't care what the content is. It could be audio, it could be video, it could be composite over IP, it could be whatever is in a stream form. It will just happily make copies of all the packets and send them on their way. And our final Game of Thrones reference, brace yourselves. The end of ISDN is coming. We already are hearing reports from markets that are not installing any new ISDN circuits. T1s are going or have gone away for the large part. There are a lot of areas where they don't have techs that know how to repair them anymore. I read some anecdotal evidence of Verizon workers being fined if they repair copper circuits. They're trying so hard to push everything into the packetized world that eventually it's going to be, you know, prohibitively expensive to get this kind of a link. So we all need to think about ways that we can use the technology that is available to duplicate the results and get us the ultimate IP audio networks that we want. And I am way short, but that's the way it is. Do we have any questions? Yeah, we got one or two.
My question is, on those impressively long connections that you held open, were you able to measure any changes in latency?
Oh, sure.
And did the latency change very much over that time?
No, we obviously there's going to be jitter, and there's I always have to stop and remind myself of the difference between latency and jitter. Right, latency is the overall delay between yes. when the content enters the network and when it comes out
at
the other end.
That's what I'm interested in.
Right. So, and then jitter is how much that figure varies over time. And with the long connection times, we're running about a 750 millisecond buffer is all on that Belfast to Miami link. Could probably be shorter. We typically see ping times of about 110, 120 milliseconds on the hop. But basically, your latency is going to be what your latency is on the network. You'll set your buffer to accommodate how much that jitter is to cope with. And basically, just you have to have your buffer has to be big enough to accommodate any long loss of connection events. So if you have an LOC and it lasts longer than the duration of the buffer that you set, then you're going to have an LOC event. And you're going to lose some packets and possibly some audio, depending on what's happening with your other redundant streams. But I remember what it was. What the technology, the way we have constructed it and we apply it, once you set that playout delay, that's where it stays. So we went into this design goal of designing our this redundant streaming technology. Two of our main design goals was that we do not affect the audio quality. That the audio quality, stays the same. We don't change the bit rate. We don't change the algorithm. So you've got top quality audio, and that the playout delay had to be very consistent, because some customers, particularly in Europe, they've got network segments and top of the hour things that they have to hit very precisely. So if the playout delay is moving at all, that can cause a problem for some customers. Yes.
Okay. This is a configuration you didn't show, but say you have a network now that satellite is getting. Changing a lot, where you'd have several end users with like a Barracks or some other codec. Mm-hmm. Can you use yours to broadcast to those?
Yeah, codec algorithm compatibility between codecs has been an ongoing challenge for the industry. There's so many different flavors of the different algorithms, and there's so many little minute details that can affect the compatibility between one codec and another. You could certainly use the packet replicator duplicator to go in between. In fact, that was our first installation of those in the U.S. was a customer in Massachusetts that had some Barracks boxes. And on their own across the network, they were iffy sometimes. But when he patched them through the duplicator and added an extra stream to it, the things got a whole lot more reliable. So, yeah, and satellite, like I say, you've got a long delay, so your overall latency is going to be 4, 5, 6 seconds. But again, you can set your buffer for much less than that, because you're really only concerned with the jitter, with the change in latency. I think we had another one. Yes.
In the multicast scenario, do you have any kind of facility built in for backhaul audio? Say you're going to three different stations, could you select one of them to talk back to you at any given point?
Yeah, you would be selecting different profiles. Selecting a different profile will cause a momentary interruption in the audio, but you could actually have them all on one profile and then just enable, you would configure outgoing multicast stream, and then your incoming stream would just be a single cast, a unicast. And you would have, if you had, say, three sources and you wanted to be able to listen to any one of those, you would have basically four or three receive streams, and you can enable and disable those receive streams depending on which one that you wanted to listen to. But yeah, it's entirely possible to do backhaul audio even in a multicast situation. You just have to decide which one you want to hear. All righty. Cool. All right. I'm going to be on the BGS booth with Mary and the gang. Stop by and say hi if you've got any other further questions or you have some ideas rattling around on your head. Happy to help out. So thank you very much. That, by the way, is me in about 19, what would that be? That would be 95. I was chief engineer for KPRS in Kansas City at the time. It's about the oldest one I could find. I actually started in 74 in high school. I was part of the radio club in high school, and then we had a weekly program that we did live on the local AM station. We did our high school news on Saturday morning. So that was where I got started in the business, and I've avoided working ever since. Thank you much for your time, Vince.